Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, it took four attempts, but finally we got to Plymouth, and it's worth it in the end, don't you?
Yeah, we had a great time, and it was fantastic for so many people to turn up, and we had people from Argyle themselves, as well as a myriad of fans. And just to cheer you up, there was a Brighton fan there as well.
There's always a Brighton fan. I think you hire them from Central Casting somewhere, because they all look like they should be called Horatio. Yeah, one chap had come down from Bolton, although he did say his mum lives in Plymouth, but that was lovely. A quick shout out. Everybody was exceptionally friendly, of course. I didn't know they didn't like being called Plymouth, Kieran. I didn't know you had to call them Argyle.
You got a bit of a hard stare there.
Friendly advice about what the locals wanted to call us. Hello, who's up? Is that Finlay going, what does it matter? They're in Plymouth. Why can't you call them Plymouth, says Finlay.
That's right.
your Amazon man's delivering late. I just want to shout out to a couple of people. I don't normally do this, Kieran, because everyone came up to chat, and I'd like to say hello to all of them. But certainly to a young lad called Matt, who was there with his dad, who are both blind football fans, who I will be getting in touch with to pick their brains about an interview we have coming up. And also, Kieran, I didn't get their names because I'm, you know, Mr. Showbiz. It's all about me and my ego. I don't always ask, Kieran. But there was a woman at the front, I'm sure you would have seen, Kieran, with her son in a wheelchair.
Yes.
And she was writing stuff down during the first half of the show. And so I assumed she might have questions to put on our pile for the second half. And I went to ask. And it turns out she said she was making notes, because it turns out she got into football because when her son was younger, she escorted him to games in his wheelchair, and she really got into football. And he loves the pod, so to be part of his life as a good mum, she is really getting into football finance as well. And she said she was just making notes in the first half, just for things to think about. And that her and her son, I got quite emotional. It was her and her son listened to the pod going to away games, and he instructs her about some of the more complicated things we're talking about because it's all new to her. So I might get someone to do that to me, Kieran, when stuff comes in. But I just thought that was lovely. I was quite proud of us as a pod, Kieran, really, but I just thought it was a lovely, tender thing to find out that this woman has become a fan of the pod to take part in her son's life, which is great. And although the downside of the conversation is I heard some eye-watering things about the way some clubs treat their fans in wheelchairs, Kieran. So we need to revisit that topic, I think. But thank you to everyone in Plymouth last night, especially director Paul Byrne, who was a very, very gracious and funny guest. And thank you to everyone who helped organise it. And thank you to everyone who came. And thank you to me, who had the bright idea. Got back to the hotel, 11:30, thought this is too early to go to bed. So just for old time's sake, I had a wander around Union Street and ended up in a late bar talking football to three sailors from Glasgow. That's a lovely nostalgic trip down memory lane. So we have quite a lot of news stories, Kieran. One of which, and seriously, people running football clubs and people doing press releases, stop doing it 3 minutes after we do one show. Literally 3 minutes after we finish recording our last show, the owners of Wigan Athletic, Kieran, it seemed initially that this was the best possible news that Wigan could hear. They seemed like they had a deal in place for a new owner, and then suddenly, Kieran.
Yes. Well, we've always said
that spoke volumes, didn't it?
It did. If something seems too good to be true, then a healthy dose of scepticism might be applied. So we all got very excited when, as you rightly said, we'd recorded the show on Sunday evening at 8:00, and we finished around about 9-ish. And we had said that we're not describing them as rats leaving a sinking ship, but the directors of Wigan had gone. We've got no confidence in the owner, Talal al-Hamed, because he's had a series of broken promises and appears to be from the fake side of the Sheikh dynasty in terms of his investment from Bahrain. And that there was a genuine concern about Wigan's ability to survive the summer if money wasn't going to come in. Then there was an announcement, and it was all a little bit vague and opaque. It's as if they've decided to put out a press release and say, no, we're not the bad guys after all, but an agreement had been made with the intention of selling Wigan Athletic to somebody new. And people were going, blimey O'Reilly, that just seems a bit strange. You know, why would two directors have resigned earlier in the day when a deal was about to be announced? And it then turns out that the person who is in theory behind all of this is friend of the podcast, Sabjat Johal, who we first came into contact with regard to a potential acquisition of another crisis club, which is Morecambe FC. He was initially involved in terms of, I think he has put some money into Morecambe, but he's not yet passed the owners and directors test. And for people not familiar with his company, which is Saab Capital, it doesn't seem to have a huge amount of money itself. He, according to the information we can find out about him, he's a 22-year-old soft drinks millionaire from Solihull, but doesn't actually appear to have many soft drinks sold. And if you take a look at the companies with which he's associated, they don't seem to have a lot of funding. So it just doesn't add up. The fact that the EFL haven't approved him to take over Morecambe raises red flags. The fact that he's now linked to Wigan, well, how is the next wage bill going to be paid? I think that's the critical thing. Where is he getting money from? Nobody's heard of the soft drinks from which he is associated. So, is this a case of new dawn fades? Or are we sort of stepping into another, frying pan and fire situation? And that's happened too often with Wigan. Dave Whelan, great owner, plays it straight down the middle, set a budget, stuck to a budget. Everybody knew where they stood. And since then, there's been a slow and accelerating deterioration in terms of the integrity and the governance taking place at that football club.
Yes, you see, you started that analogy with a Joy Division song in New Dawn Fades, and I was expecting you to end with one. But unless Frying Pan into Fire is a version of a Joy Division song I've not heard on a bootleg that only you've got. Two issues out of this, Kieran. One of which we talked about last night in Plymouth. The first one is that Morecambe fans may disagree, but Wigan are a demonstrably bigger club than Morecambe. They've won the FA Cup in recent memory. Their fan base is bigger. So it seems odd that he was struggling to buy Morecambe, it seemed, and now suddenly he's putting in a bid for Wigan, which you assume blows his bid for Morecambe out of the water, I guess. And secondly, and this was the issue I was particularly interested in, if it turned out that this young man from Solihull was on the line, was actually a multimillionaire with impeccable credentials, and he took over the club and he put up 25 million quid and said to the EFL, look, here's the money for the next 10 seasons, wages will be paid. Is there a chance then that the EFL would say, well, okay, the 8-point deduction was given to previous owners, it's only fair that you don't have to deal with that?
Right, let's deal with each of those issues in turn. You're absolutely right. Wigan is a club with a bigger fan base, has got more property assets in terms of both stadium and training facilities, and also has been in the Championship as recently as a month ago, in effect. So it has more potential. You'd expect the price to be higher. I think the hurdle, as far as Sabjat Johal is concerned, is not the money, assuming that he does have it. It's the fact that the EFL, for whatever reason, are not willing to give him the green light to go ahead with the deal. And if they're not, and then they're going on from what you've been saying, if they're not willing for him to take over Morecambe, there's no way they'd be willing for him to take over Wigan Athletic. So, so that is a concern. If he, however, can demonstrate that he does have the funds, and you know, you and I, we have discussed offline where we believe his money is coming from. Could that be part of a negotiating chip to reverse the points deduction that Wigan Athletic have had as far as 23-24 is concerned? Remember, they've had 2 points deductions in the season we just had, and they're effectively starting with 2 points deductions for 23-24. I think personally it's a long shot.
Right.
And the reason for that is that if I was the owner of another club in League One, I'd be saying, well, we've set up a budget on the basis of Wigan starting the season at minus 8 points. We quite like the idea of Wigan Athletic starting the season on minus 8 points because, let's be fairly brutal, everybody acts in self-interest and there is a high chance that Wigan will be relegated because they're starting behind the other clubs and effectively they are unable to recruit players for 23-24. Because if I was an agent, or even indeed if I was the player or the player's family, why join a football club that has failed to pay wages on 5 occasions in the last 12 months? So it could, and certainly somebody, you know, we did have this discussion live at Plymouth, and we did answer every single question. So for those people who are have been waiting 7 or 8 months for us to answer a question on the Monday show, and there is a workaround to this. It's we will hope to have a few more dates announced fairly soon, but I think it's highly unlikely that the EFL would reverse that position, and they'd say you either buy the club as it is in terms of inheriting both the assets and the liability in the form of the points deduction, or you go and find something else to play with.
Because that's another worry for Wigan fans, isn't it, Kieran, that people who have generally got the money to buy the club have to deal with the fact they're buying a club that's possibly going down again. Mm. So that's another level, isn't it? Just between you and I, Kieran, let's pretend we're offline again for a second. we didn't answer quite every question last night, as I didn't put two of them to you because they were about Moscow. And the Baroness was there. So I thought in the circumstances, especially every time we mentioned the word Baroness, she shouted from the back, "My name is Gail." I thought it was probably best that I didn't ask those questions. Filed,
that's very wise.
also filed, Kieran, in the drawer marked, "Be careful what you wish for," Charlton fans, which again, we mentioned the idea that Charlton were a rich club for potential investment. And then just moments after we mentioned that, it turns out that another old friend of the pod has got himself involved there.
Yes. Charlton, again, has announced that they have agreed a deal in principle. But again, this will have to go through due process with the EFL. And it's Thomas Sandgaard, who I think it's fair to say has a fairly checkered but brief history as owner of Charlton Athletic. And he's on our naughty step because he failed. And I bear a grudge, as you know.
Of course.
We agreed with Thomas that he could come, you know, he'd come on the show, and we were really looking forward to having a chat with him as a guest as to, you know, the rationale behind buying a football club and his plans for Charlton. And on both occasions, he just failed to turn up. So, yep. Yeah, that automatically gets red ink from me. The agreement is with a company called SE7 Partners. Mm. And SE7 Partners was fronted by our very good friend Charlie Methven. And Charlie, for people who are unfamiliar with him, he was part of the ownership group at Sunderland. He featured quite prominently on the Sunderland Till I Die documentary. He didn't necessarily come out of it spectacularly well, although he was, I always felt that he was very upfront and very candid with his comments. So it looks like he had this company called SE7 Partners. And then sort of 24 hours later, SE7 Partners announced that it was now controlled by a company called Global Football Partners, which is based in Grand Cayman in the Cayman Islands. Mm. And who owns SE7 Partners via Global Football Partners? Well, thanks to the somewhat opaque nature of governance and transparency in Grand Cayman, we don't know. Now, you know, clearly the EFL will insist that that they are given due access. But again, it makes you feel slightly uncomfortable. I went on to Google Maps and I managed to find the building which now controls Charlton Athletic, in theory, once, you know, assuming if this deal goes through. And I think it's fair to say I'd quite like it as a holiday home, but it didn't set off what you'd call a particularly business style vibe. It's right next to the beach, and there is a very pleasant yacht parked there, and I suspect it might be a brass plate address rather than something from which decisions are going to be made.
At least, Kieran, it's some consolation for Charlton fans that it's on Grand Cayman. I mean, that indicates it's not on one of the little Caymans, it's on the big one. Yes. So he must have some money. Charlie Meffin, you mentioned too candid. I think that's an understatement somewhat. When you're overheard explaining that most of your fans are too dim to work out the financial strategy of the club that is being bought, I think that goes way beyond candid, Kieran, doesn't it? In a way.
Yes.
And also, Charlie Meffin, I feel it's a warning to anyone who takes over at Charlton. Charlton have got some fans there who are forensic in their investigation of the finances of their club owners, and quite rightly so, given what's gone on in the recent past. So you need to make sure that everything is above board, because you will get called out by the fans at Charlton, Kieran, won't you?
Yeah. The Charlton dossier, if people ever have got a spare few minutes, is always worth a read. It doesn't hold back, but I think it is scrupulously objective in terms of its interrogation of the backgrounds and the details surrounding a series of owners of the club, and you can perhaps understand why there is so much scepticism amongst the Charlton fan base.
Our third story, Kieran, is about another takeover, and this is one that's been coming and going like the tide on a Devon beach, Kieran.
Yes, this is Sheffield United.
Again, yeah.
And yes, and it's an investigation by an organisation called Hindenburg Research into the Tingo Group, which is owned by Dozy Mwobwosi. I think it's fair to say that there's two things that I pick up from the Hindenburg Research. A, they don't seem to like the Tingo Group. There's a number of pretty scathing accusations about assets which don't appear to exist, about the owner claiming to have a degree, but the awarding institution appears to have no record of him. And it sets out a fairly damning assessment of both the company, the group, and its owner. But Hindenburg Research also is active in stock markets, and it makes its money through a method called short selling. And the way that you make money in short selling is that you sell shares which you don't own, and then you buy them back at a lower price. Normally, when you sell shares, you've got 24, perhaps 48 hours before. Yeah, let's say that I agree that I'm going to sell you some cheese today. And I say, I'll drop it round on Friday. And we agree a price, but I don't actually own any cheese. And I agree to sell you cheese at £5 a kilo. I'm hoping that the price of cheese is going to fall. and in the 48 hours before I go round to your house to deliver it, that I'm able to pick up some cheese for £4 a kilo. So I make money by assuming that prices are going to fall. Now, one way of getting prices to fall is to put out fairly damning, very explosive assessments of the company. So what Hindenburg Research appear to have done is to say, we're going to sell some shares in Tingo Group, but we don't actually own them yet. But by the time we come to settle the deal, which is, say, 48 hours, we hope that the share price of Tingo is going to dive. We will pick up the shares at a lower price, and we make the money from this method called short selling. So when I first saw the report, my reaction was, holy moly, this is very, very damning. And now part of me is rowing back because Hindenburg Research has a degree of self-interest for the price of the Tingo Group to fall. Having said that, there are libel laws and slander laws, and that they apply to companies who have their shares traded. So, Hindenburg Research, if it has published falsehoods, it is in trouble. And if it hasn't, then Tingo Group doesn't look like a very safe vehicle. And again, they've been connected with the potential purchase of Sheffield United for a long period of time, and the EFL have not yet approved the deal. And there's a reason why the EFL has not approved that deal.
So there is cheese involved. I mean, I'm trying to get my head. So you promised me some cheese.
Yeah, we agree a price today.
Right, and you're going to deliver it on Friday, tomorrow. But in the meantime, you're going to tweet that cheese is rubbish.
Yeah.
And the hope that people go, yeah, he's right, cheese is overrated and the price of cheese goes down.
That's right. So I then pick up the cheese at a lower price and give it to you at the agreed price that we set out today.
But I'm still getting cheese.
You're still getting cheese.
Okay, fine.
You're getting cheese at today's price of £5 a kilo. I don't actually own the cheese yet. I'm hoping that by saying rude things about cheese, I can buy it from £4 a kilo tomorrow and make my money, buy for four, sell for five.
Gotcha. Okay. And I can't decide whether Hindenburg Research into the Tingo Group sounds more like the precy of a Doctor Who episode or a cryptic crossword clue. Three down, four letters. Inter Milan, Kieran, have one of the most iconic kits, shirts, especially in world football, basically, and they will be showing off that kit in the Champions League final, but it will have something different on the front.
Yes, Internazionale, as we I guess should call them.
Kieran, I'll stop you. I had enough trouble with Plymouth fans last night. Really, it's Inter's fine. When we do the live show in Milan, we'll cope with that then. Basically, Argyle fans. Sorry, I said Plymouth fans again, didn't I? Argyle fans.
Yes. Inter had a deal with a digital organisation called Digital Bits. We were bemoaning and mourning the loss of Pirelli on the front of those classic shirts. But there was a slight problem in that Digital Bits didn't actually pay the money that was due to Inter, and therefore Inter cancelled the deal. And for a couple of months now, they've been playing with nothing on the front of their shirts. But they've signed a very, very late deal with Paramount Plus. So it's a two match deal. Their final away match in Serie A against Torino, they wore their away kit. And they will be wearing, in the Champions League final against Manchester City, with those iconic colours, this Paramount Plus logo on the front of their shirts. Now, there's also talk about Paramount Plus signing a back-of-shirt deal for season 23-24. So we await that. We don't yet have back-of-shirt sponsors in the Premier League. But whether that will manifest itself, because we know that the Premier League has agreed to say that it's not going to have any front of shirt gambling sponsors, but it will have sleeve sponsors who are gambling. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, well, that's leaving the back of the shirt, which doesn't appear to have been mentioned yet by the Premier League. So is this the way that things are going to go in the future?
Yeah, we're going to end up like France, Kieran, where every bit of the kit has got a sponsor's name on it. Do we know how much Paramount Plus have paid for this two-shirt deal?
No. It's all, I think, been a bit rushed, and none of the journalists have managed to get numbers, but Inter did get stung quite severely. I think their deal for the season with Digital Bits was worth in the region of 30 to 35 million euro. So for a couple, they might have got a couple of million euro, given that we're not going to say the eyes of the world, because I think that's an arrogant European thing to do. Hmm. But the Champions League final on Saturday is going to attract a huge audience.
It's a strange thing for football fans, Kieran, how some brands, if you like, shirt sponsors have become iconic in a way. In the way that Palace fans will happily buy shirts with TDK on, old ones, or Virgin Atlantic, but won't touch ones with Man Bet X. And like you say, that Pirelli, I would much prefer shirts to have nothing on the front. But yeah, you're quite right. It seems like an international shirt should have that. And as we talked again last night, the Ginsters' relationship with Plymouth has become kind of iconic as well. Although it's a local Plymouth foundation that's on the front of the shirt at the moment, but it's sponsored. That's itself is sponsored by Ginsters. So some brand relations with clubs work much better in fans' eyes than others, don't they? And presumably that's the holy grail for somebody who's looking to sell the front of their shirt, isn't it?
That's right. You're looking for something symbolic. You're looking for it's a bit like when a brand becomes a verb. So we talk about hoovering. We talk about Googling. And every time we use that language, we're actually giving away a brand name which has become so embedded into modern thinking that it is used as a means of a whole industry. So yeah, you can absolutely understand it. And let's face it, Italian kits do look cool, especially on Italian people, in my view.
Yeah.
It's not quite the same for when you see them down at Eastbourne Beach, worn on blokes from North London who have also got rolled up handkerchiefs on their head.
When's this happening, Kieran? The 50s? What's happening here?
You've not been to Eastbourne recently. Eastbourne is the 50s.
Yeah, no, fair point. It's just a very pleasing time travel image of an elderly English chap with a handkerchief on his head and his trousers rolled up and a brand new Inter Milan shirt with Paramount Plus written on the front.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
This next story, Kieran, I'm surprised hasn't been a bigger one than it has. I didn't put that very elegantly, but it's about UEFA and their fear of Premier League clubs dominating in Europe. And it's not one that's really made the headlines here, and it kind of should do, really, because it's a very interesting, slightly worrying development.
Yes, this story was broken by Martin Ziegler in the Times a few days ago. Other clubs in Europe are very jealous of the Premier League because the Premier League has done some things spectacularly right. They've made some very, very smart decisions. And one of the smartest decisions that's ever been made is to go into the international broadcast markets and to say, hi, we're the Premier League, we're the new kids on the block. This was happening in 1992. We've got this new product. We've got live TV taking place over, you know, off, remember when it started, it was sort of, you know, 2-3 days spread over the weekend. Mm. Do you fancy trying it? And I tell you what, we're so confident in it, we're going to give it to you for nothing. And the subscription channels in, you know, in Thailand, in Nigeria, in Australia, in, you know, and so on, they said, yeah, this is fantastic. We'll have some of that. And the Premier League noticed the level of interest from viewers. So when those deals came up for renewal in 3 or 4 years' time, they said, we're willing to renew that contract, but this time we want some money. And if you don't pay us what we want, we're going to go to your competitors who are more than happy to give us what we think the deal is worth. And that is why we are now in the position, for the first time in history, that the Premier League's international TV rights exceed the value of the domestic rights. In Germany, they're probably making around about 10 to 15% of what the Premier League make from international rights. Mm. Premier League goes to 187 different countries. And this has given the Premier League this competitive advantage in terms of the money coming in. So under the new UEFA financial and sustainability rules, we have something called a soft salary cap. And the soft salary cap works as wages are capped as a proportion of income. Now, there's agents' fees and net transfer spend and various other bits and pieces that go into it. But the best way to think of it is it's a you're allowed to spend initially 90, then 80, then 70% of your income on player wages. The problem with such an approach is that it preserves the gaps in football. So if we take, for example, Manchester City, who have income of £613 million, 70% of that allows them to spend £429 million on wages. If we take Palace's income last season, £160 million, so therefore they can only pay wages of £112 million. So Manchester City have effectively, because they've got close on four times the amount of income, they've effectively got four times the amount that they can invest in wages. Let's say that a billionaire comes into Palace and says, I want to put a huge amount of money into the club. I want Palace to become the new Newcastle. Under these rules, it makes it very difficult for that to be the case. And that also applies on a European basis. And we've already seen, we've been talking about one team in Milan. Well, Bournemouth outbid AC Milan earlier in this season for a player, because Bournemouth are part of the Premier League. So what is now being discussed is what we referred to as a hard cap. And a hard cap simply works as this. You cannot spend more than, let's say, £200 million a year on wages.
Right.
And that applies across the whole of Europe. And that means that those clubs at the elite end of the Premier League, they would have to plan to reduce their wage bills. That would mean that it would be more competitive for the clubs in the other big four leagues in Europe and potentially some of the clubs in other countries as well. Otherwise, the fear is that the Premier League will be dominant in Europe, although, you know, we've seen a resurgence of Italian football this year as far as UEFA competitions are concerned. Real Madrid have won the Champions League, as it was, five times in the last decade. I don't think the scare stories are as bad or as they're made out to be, but there is a fear and a concern within Europe and within UEFA, and this is one way of addressing it. This is what happens in US franchise sports. So if we go to the NFL, the cap's £181 million a year, and if you exceed it, you get penalised pretty heavily, and this stops clubs winning franchise competitions year in, year out, which isn't necessarily great for those of us that want a bit of variety in trophy winners.
What do you think the response of Premier League clubs would be to a hard cap, Kieran? Or is there any way they could respond all the while they remain in UEFA?
Well, there is something called the European Club Association, which does have, I think it has around about 200 members. But interestingly, only a small number of its members can actually vote on decisions. So I think there could be some resistance from the European Club Association if this is imposed by UEFA. Certainly, the players' unions are likely to push back on this because they would see this as an attempt by the authorities to reduce their members' income. And then we come to the thorny issue of tax, because if you talk to players' representatives, we're always talking about such and such a player is coming in on X pounds per week. Talk to agents, they say, I don't care what the gross salary is. My player is interested in netto. And I don't mean the discount greengrocers. When we're talking about netto, how much money is going into the player's bank account on a month-by-month basis? The trouble is, in the UK, we've got a higher rate of tax of 45%, and then you've got national insurance issues on top. You go to Germany, you've got a different tax rate. You go to Luxembourg, you go to the Republic of Ireland. And because you've got 55 member countries in UEFA, you've got 55 different tax regimes and potentially 55 different tax rates. And in fact, even if you go to somewhere like Switzerland, the different cantons within Switzerland, they have individual tax rates, and it all gets very messy and very complicated. So I think it would be difficult to enforce, and there's likely to be legal challenges from the players' unions. But I think it does show the strength of feeling and the concerns in relation to the Premier League's dominance that is perceived by other countries and clubs within Europe.
Now, Kieran, it was supposed to be over and done with in a week, but the Manchester United sales story drags on. And as my Uncle Donny would have said in Glasgow, getting rid of the Glazer siblings is a little bit like trying to unwrap a Randy Octopus from a set of bagpipes. Because they are, which is 3 o'clock in the morning in a Glasgow bar, that's much funnier because you don't tend to look at the reality of how that's come about. How's the octopus got into Edinburgh in the first place, or who's dropped their bagpipes but anyway, they're clinging on, Kieran, is what I'm saying.
Yes, so we have the two potential bidders for Manchester United, and the latest noises that are coming out, which are being strategically leaked by Sir Jim Ratcliffe's PR people, is that he's now willing to allow the six Glazer children to still have some shares so long as he gets up and has 51%. 51% means that it allows you to appoint the board of directors. It allows you effectively to control the transfer budget. It allows you to dictate how much money is going to be spent on infrastructure and borrowings and so on. And if this is the case, I think it's fair to say it's going to go down very, very poorly with the Manchester United fan base. We've also heard, and this is coming out, we're recording on the evening of Wednesday the 7th. We've also heard that there has been a final bid from Sheikh Jassim, which is going to clear the debt of Manchester United, it's to buy 100% of the shares, and effectively it will take the club private again, take it off the stock market. I did see those legendary words, transfer war chest. Now, I don't know what a war chest is.
I traditionally, Kieran, it was a royal. It was a chest that had all the money you saved up as a king to go to war with, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. But he wasn't looking to sign a left back.
Henry VIII, when he bankrupted the country to go on yet another war with France, most certainly wasn't looking to buy another left back. No, I think I can say that with some certainty, Kieran. This conversation's taken a severe handbrake turn. I wasn't expecting to have to explain what a war chest is, but, you know, I'll happily, that's a pod for another day, Kieran. Kevin Day explains to a baffled Kieran Maguire what historical terms mean. And you might understand then how I feel about some of the financial stories, Kieran.
Yes. Tremendous.
How's the bee situation, Kieran? Have you got rid of all your bees?
Well, now, the good news is that the bee man... who has taken the queen? He took about 2,000 bees on Sunday, wow. And we were very happy about that. And he was quite morose because he was telling us that you're fortunate. This is all down to Brexit because under the rules that we now have, which are not part of the EU rules, we can now use insecticides which kill honeybees. Honeybees are good. So, yeah, I think that's a very, very... But that does mean that actually there's now a spare hive. But about 200 bees have returned because they've got the scent of the queen and they think that she's still there. And the tragic news is that they have sort of formed this... this area to protect her, which again is on in the side of our front wall, but they're going to die over the course of the next few days, and you can't scoop them up because they'll just fly back to where they think the queen is. So, 90% success, 10% bad bee news coming up.
I wish I hadn't raised the subject now, Kieran, but I was trying to find a way of getting off war chests. Let's get back. How much if Sheikh Jassim is offering to pay off Man United's debts, buy all the shares, and provide a sum of money for transfers, Kieran? That strikes me as an enormous amount of money. How much would you think that's going to cost him?
It's going to cost realistically an initial close on $6 billion plus whatever he's going to commit to the transfer budget. Plus, there's the elephant in the room, which is the substandard Old Trafford in terms of facilities available for fans. So, if Spurs cost best part of $1.25 billion, then a new appropriate Old Trafford with the capacity, Manchester United can sell 90,000 easily. The only constraint is going to be physically getting to and from the ground, sort of transport things and those issues. You're not going to get change out of $2 billion for a proper revamp of the stadium. So it could be a very significant sum of money, but you are talking about an iconic brand in world sport.
Yeah, and of course the good news is for Sheikh Jassim is that Man United are looking to sell Harry Maguire, so that'd be what? That'd be £3 million.
Yes.
Guess, wouldn't you? We talked about Inter and their shirt sponsor, Kieran, two domestic shirt sponsor stories, both of which are very interesting in their own right. And the first one is Newcastle.
Yes. Newcastle's deal with Fun 88 was due to expire in 2024. By all accounts, Fun 88, which is a Chinese gambling company, are paying around about £7 to 8 million a year, which is the going rate for effectively a white label gambling sponsor. Newcastle, I think, are going to announce, if the stories are true, a deal with a Middle Eastern based company, the Selar Group, which is a Saudi events company. And that's going to be somewhere in the region of three times the amount. It's going to be £25 million a year. That will have to go to the Fair Value Committee that's been set up by the Premier League to try to stop clubs from manipulating their finances by having friendly sponsors. But with Newcastle A finishing third in the Premier League, appearing more often on television as a result of that, and qualifying for the Champions League next season, I think they'll be in a fairly strong position to defend a £25 million a year deal. There'd have to be evidence of step downs if they subsequently don't qualify for the Champions League. But the commercial income of Newcastle flatlined throughout the ownership period of Mike Ashley, and clearly it's one area that the club is both keen and able to address. because Mike Ashley himself became a toxic element as far as relationships between sponsors and the club was concerned, because they knew that there would be boycotts, they knew that there would be negative publicity put out by the Newcastle fan base if the sponsors got involved with Mike Ashley's Newcastle.
It's been quite a handy week, Kieran, for people like Amnesty International and other opponents of the Saudi regime who are accusing them of sports washing on a huge scale, with Saudi not only buying the Saudi government, not only buying the top four clubs in the country, but essentially buying golf as well.
Yes, that's an absolutely staggering decision. And I appreciate that, you know, this isn't a golf show. But as somebody that we mutually know in the world of broadcasting said, they're not trying to buy the branches off the tree. They've just gone and bought the whole tree. You had these two competing bodies. That's very weird. And as for PIF buying for football clubs in Saudi Arabia, well, clearly they've got the funds to do so. So the financial perspective is not an issue. But that does raise the thorny concern of, well, how competitive is the game going to be? Because if I own four football clubs in the same league, and I think there's only 12 teams in the league anyway, there is the opportunity to perhaps reduce competitive tensions in certain matches. If you're trying to get into, for example, the FIFA World Club Championship, and you need to finish in the top two in Saudi to go into the playoffs for the MENA area, then those results can be arranged by a little bit of soft pressure from the owner. So it looks uncomfortable. The ability of these clubs to recruit players and pay them transformative amounts of money for young men that are already rich. Kante, who is one of the players I think it's difficult not to love, he's going to be paid $100 million a year if he accepts the contract. And you can't really say to the players, well, you shouldn't take it, because it's perfectly legal to do so. And it's an incredible amount of money. And the chances are there won't be very much tax paid on that either.
Well, it's all very reminiscent, Kieran. Back in the early 90s, when BSB and Sky were in a battle to see who would become the dominant satellite station, both of them were offering stupid amounts of money to mid-level comedians to do mid-level comedian stuff. And they were two of the best years we had. And not that long ago, we had China becoming the logical place for 29, 30-year-old European footballers to go. And now we're seeing, credible rumours that Wilf Zaha has been offered £275,000 a week to go and play out there. It's obviously sustainable financially wise, but it does remind you of those heady days of China offering everybody in the world more money than they've ever seen, isn't it?
Yes, and we've seen it in cricket with the IPL.
Yeah, indeed.
The potential death of one day cricket in this country on the back of that. You can expect to see it potentially in other sports. And you and I are also old enough to remember Kerry Packer.
Indeed.
And pyjama cricket, yeah. And the reaction of the establishment when that took place, where somebody came along and cricketers were very poorly paid. It was a doff your cap type of existence, but the money they were on was ridiculously low, and along comes somebody and disrupts the whole market.
The other shirt sponsor story, Kieran, in English football is a club operating at, shall we say, financial levels several divisions below that of Newcastle, and that's Coventry.
Yes. Doug King, the new owner of Coventry, has said the deal with Boyle Sports, again, a gambling company, that's due to end, and he doesn't want to renew, even though the EFL, the Sky Bet Championship, in which Coventry are competing, is it self-sponsored by a gambling entity? And the EFL have said, yeah, we're not going to follow the Premier League. And in addition to that, betting kiosks in the stadium are going to be removed as well. And he says he doesn't want to put temptation. You know, if anybody that has had a family member or a friend or a loved one who has a gambling addiction, it is very difficult. And I think you've got to give Doug King a lot of credit. He does appear to be very genuine in wanting not to reduce people's enjoyment. You know, we've said on many occasions that, you know, we both have place wagers on football matches, but to create an environment where people who have suffered on the wrong side of the gambling industry don't feel as much of the constant pressure as would otherwise be the case.
Yeah, we talk about this every week here, and so I don't want to discuss it further, but I will say one thing, and this came up last night because we had a question from one of our audience members in Plymouth, which is, which companies are wealthy enough to replace betting sponsors? So there's a risk involved in Doug King doing that, but it's entirely up to him, and I think a lot of Coventry fans will be very happy with what he's done. Sad news for Reading's women's team, Kieran.
Yes, and this is always a potential problem following relegation. Now Reading have had a double whammy this season in the sense that the men's team has been relegated from the Championship to League One, and that means that their broadcast income will reduce by around about 75% to 80%. They were already losing large sums of money. They were already playing close to double their income in the form of wages in the Championship. The women's team was also relegated from the WSL to the Championship. In the WSL, you get 75% of the overall TV money, 25% in the Championship. And as a result of this, Reading have said, we are no longer willing to run a professional women's team in the Championship. Now, you know, the average salary in the WSL is only £27,000 a week. Sorry, £27,000 a year. So apologies for that. It's less than that in the Championship, and the fact that they can't even match those wages, or they don't plan to, is a concern. And I think the broader issue of the funding and the sustainability of the women's game, when there is a very close relationship to the men's team, when the men's team is relegated, and this could be from the Premier League to the Championship or the Championship to League One, there's always a knock-on effect. Now, that doesn't mean that the women's teams of Southampton, Leeds and Leicester are at risk. I know for at least one of those clubs, I know Southampton have been very progressive, but it does show that there is a degree of dependency upon the men's team maintaining its position. And if it loses that position and gets relegated, there are ramifications, not just for jobs, but also for in the back office, but also for issues such as academies and women's teams as well.
Well, it also indicates, Kieran, the actual reality of the women's game at the moment. Because if you were to ask most football fans what they thought of the women's game, they would say, well, it's flourishing. You know, World Cup games are going to be sold out. Wembley's sold out every time the Lionesses play. We're seeing great crowds in the Women's Premier League, the Women's Super League, I beg your pardon. But at the coalface, at grassroots level and above, it's really struggling, Kieran.
Yes, and trying to come up with a long-term strategy for the women's game, because it's a bit like a startup business, and you know, it does come up with a series of different hurdles. And I think sadly the worst thing that happens is that because the men's game, especially at Premier League level, is flourishing so much, people are automatically comparing.
Yeah.
The women's game to the men's game.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the women's game is more akin to something such as rugby league or county cricket, in the sense that it's fighting for eyeballs and it's fighting for broadcasting slots against the Premier League, which is this behemoth, which is, you know, dominating the sporting landscape so much.
It's interesting you mentioned rugby league, Kieran. I was speaking to Claire Boarding recently for another project, and she says that the constant comparisons between women's football and men's football are not helpful. And when it comes to the broadcasting deal for women, for example, she said, don't compare it to the men's broadcasting deal because nothing in the world of sport will ever come close to that. Compare it to the men's deal for broadcasting rugby league or rugby union. And when you do that, it's a comparatively healthy comparison.
Yes.
I can't believe I said comparatively in comparison in the same sentence, Kieran. I need to stop beating myself up about these things. Kieran, it's rare that we get, we've got a couple of stories left. They're not massive stories, but this one, I think, in its own way, is as big a story as we've been able to announce recently, and it's unremittingly, I hope, good news.
Yes, this is in respect of Hensford Town. There was an announcement about a month ago that the club was not going to be able to play football in 23-24. It was going to have to withdraw from the Northern Premier League. It's got the fourth highest attendances in that, you know, averages around about 500.
Yeah.
We've always said part of the community gives people a purpose, gets people out of the house, you know, gets you walking, gets you talking. There's so many positives about football. And the owner, you know, the club had been losing money. The owner said, I can't afford to fund it, or I'm not going to fund it. But, you know, and there were directors' loans outstanding of around about £2 million looking at the accounts. Somebody has come forward. I think he is the former vice chairman. To be fair, he said, I have made mistakes. I think he's had perhaps a prickly relationship with some of the fans historically. But let's put that all to one side. Let's work for the common good. It's good news, you know, and you know, look forward to them ideally competing in that league next year and hope they go from strength to strength.
Yeah, and if the deal is done, it would be lovely to talk to somebody from Hensford Town as well. Mm. Kieran, I rarely say this to you, but I've got a bone to pick with you, Kieran.
Oh.
In times gone by, you've said to me that Palace are probably worth about 250, 260 million quid. So that's what I tell, in the Pawson's Arms, people will sidle up to me and go, you know a bit about this football finance stuff. And I go, no, I don't. I read out the questions. But they would then say, well, what does your mate Kieran think Palace is worth? And I'll go 250, 260. Lo and behold, all the WhatsApp groups, social media, etc., Palace fans this week, because Forbes would go, 680 million quid they reckon we're worth. What's going on, Kieran?
Yes. Forbes have published their 20 most valuable, I think the 30 most valuable football clubs. Now,
sorry, perhaps we should explain who Forbes are to some people.
Well, Forbes magazine. Forbes is the magazine for extremely wealthy individuals.
It
looks at the lifestyles of the rich and the famous,
right.
and communicates those. And it's very aspirational. And it talks to, you know, millionaires and billionaires and big corporations and so on. American sport is associated with a lot of wealth. But Forbes has come up with what it considers to be the top 30 most valuable football clubs on the planet. Now, three of the clubs in the top 20 are from Major League Soccer. And I go, well, yeah, I've been to some MLS games. I've had great fun attending MLS games. But if you take a look at the most valuable US club, which is LAFC, their revenue is around about £80 million. That's just beyond what Fulham made in the Championship. It's considerably less than every club in the Premier League. It's less than Celtic and Rangers made, I think, last season in the SPFL. And you know, Rangers and Celtic and Bournemouth and Brighton, you know, they're not in the top 20 clubs. So why are LAFC and LA Galaxy and so on? So that seemed a bit strange. And then this figure came out in respect of Palace, and it intuitively looked wrong. And this isn't me being critical of Palace, you know, I've said, you know, I admire Palace for getting to the Premier League and B, having a strategy where they've maintained their position in the Premier League, and they should be applauded for that. But Palace have been valued considerably more than Newcastle United. Mm. Now, Newcastle United have a 52,000 capacity stadium. Palace's is 25,000. Newcastle United are playing in the Champions League next season. Palace are playing in the Premier League only. So where did they get these figures from? I have given valuations historically to Forbes of one or two clubs. And I always use a consistent method. I think the issue here is that Forbes actually talk to probably, you know, 15 to 20 different people in the industry who'd use different methodologies to value football clubs. And a journalist from Forbes would say, can you give me figures for Crystal Palace and Fulham? Can you give me figures for Manchester United and Newcastle? And if the methods are different and there are huge differences and assumptions and some are forward-looking and some are historic-looking, valuing a football club is not a science. It's not even art. It's glorified guesswork supported by very intense people who are able to shout out words like amortization and discounted cash flows very, very confidently. But the numbers, I don't want to say that they're ultimately a load of old bollocks, but they are. I can understand, you know, Newcastle fans were very upset about this, and I'm just saying, just don't take the numbers too seriously. Ultimately, a football club is a trophy asset. It's like buying a work of art. How much are you willing to pay for an individual Banksy? That varies upon, you know, what you think of it and, you know, what other people think it's worth. So, yeah, I did. This isn't a Crystal Palace. I don't think they're worth £686 million.
Well, two things, Kieran. I'll tell you how much I'm prepared to pay for a Banksy. £30. Not a fan.
Right.
The frustrating thing is, Kieran, I was halfway to crowdfunding £240 million to buy Palace. I don't think they're going to take the extra £400 million. Is going to take a lot of raising, Kieran. It's just knocked me a little bit, Kieran. That's all. We were halfway there. I mean, obviously, producer guy turned me down with a £30 million I asked him for. He reads Forbes, doesn't he? I imagine producer.
Yes, he writes it.
Two more stories to go, Kieran, and one of them is better than the other. We've spoken a lot about the Football Association of Ireland in the 3 years plus that we've been doing the pod. Very rarely in a positive fashion, but for once we can rectify that.
Yes,
we can't.
Well,
okay, sorry.
Well, it also involves Mike Ashley. So,
hey, what? Okay,
yes. The FAI borrowed money from Sports Direct, from Mike Ashley's Sports Direct, and it was around about €6.5 million. I think it's fair to say that the FAI were not run on a particularly sustainable basis by John Delaney. I've always said, you know, read the book Champagne Football if you want to find out a bit more about Mr. Delaney. He's quite a sensitive soul, so yeah, the fact that this book managed to get through the lawyers was an achievement in itself. There was a substantial amount due. Sports Direct, when a deal collapsed, demanded all of its money back. The FAI then said, we're going to be paying back at €100,000 a month. And it has been doing so. But it looks as if now there's a new agreement between Sports Direct and the FAI, which means effectively they won't have to be doing any repayments and Sports Direct are making a contribution towards Irish football. But until you see the small print, I'm always very, very cautious. Mike Ashley is a very, very smart businessman. You know, regardless of what you might think of him in some other aspects of his life, but he is very good at getting very, very good deals for himself.
With hindsight, Kieran, perhaps we should have finished with the Hensford story, because I don't like finishing on a downbeat note. But for Partick Thistle fans, it is very much a downbeat note.
Yes. We've had the Jags Foundation on the show. There clearly was a a poor relationship between the board and the fan base. And I think it was Colin Weir who was the successful fan who won the lottery, who effectively bequeathed some money to Partick Thistle. Mm. Partick Thistle is losing money. It would have lost a lot more money had it not reached the playoffs for promotion and relegation, and also had it not had a cup match against Rangers. But the board are saying that we're losing money. We're handing across the club to the Jags Foundation and effectively giving them a hospital pass. And the Jags Foundation are saying, well, you know, we think we should have been working more closely, but there's not been a good relationship between the board and the foundation. It is now trying to crowdfund. I've seen its tweets that have gone out, in fact, during the recording of the show, saying, well, yeah, the good news is that more people are wanting to join the foundation. They realise that we are on the side of the angels. That can't necessarily be said about some of the other people connected to the club. So, yeah, it's messy. It's sad. You know, I think they're going to have a significant reduction in budgets, which is a shame for the forthcoming season, because, you know, we all know what it's like at football fans. You come to the end of a season, you park it, you have a moan for a few days, and then you start thinking, when are the fixtures out? Who are we going to be signing? And we've got a very good way as football fans as putting things behind us. But the last thing you want to know that next year is going to be tough as well.
Do you know, Kieran, it seems odd not to end a pod by trying to flog the last two tickets at Plymouth, like we have been doing for the past 3 months. But we will be in a situation in a week or two, hopefully, maybe a bit longer than that, to announce another tranche of live tour dates. We'll certainly be going to Ireland, hopefully Jersey, that's certainly in the northwest of England and Scotland. So we'll be back to you soon with some news about that. We've got some other news, which I think has been leaked on social media, about a Price of Football project, which will be available shortly. In the meantime, thanks to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod as well, that would be very kind. And you can go to patreon.com/priceoffootball to do so. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. I'm off to watch, sounds like I'm off to Istanbul to watch West Ham in the, what's it called, conference final, but I'm not. I'm off to the room next door. And I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Yeah, I won't be watching the football because I'm appearing on The Moral Maze on Radio 4.
I didn't want to tell people that, as I thought they would think I was making it up. But
which is bizarre. It'll be the first time I've ever broadcast from my front room wearing a dinner jacket, because it's Radio 4 after all. And
again,
even I have to have some form of standards.
Kieran, I'll take you back to the earlier discussion about people sitting on beaches with knotted handkerchiefs. They're not quite dinner jackets. I just think, how proud would Uncle Terry be to go? Imagine the moral maze that Uncle Terry negotiated throughout his entire life.
Yeah, left kneecap all right. Yeah. But thank you everybody who has supported the show. Thank you for everybody who came to see us and the patience you showed in terms of Plymouth. There were circumstances beyond our control, beyond the club's control and so on, and we had a great time. There's another way that you can support the show, and that's to give us a review using your app. We don't know how it quite worked. It's something, you know, we have meetings with producer guy, and he shows us charts and he points at things and he shouts algorithms at us. But You can write whatever you want. You could even say you would rather have the show presented by Adam of Adam and the Ants and Scrappy Doo of Scooby Doo.
Ooh, they're both quite well dressed, aren't they? Oh no, actually, Scrappy doesn't wear much. I loved Adam and the Ants. The two of them. He did Buzzcocks once. He was absolutely charming, but he's tiny.
Oh, I'm really pleased to see that.
Oh, he's a tiny little fella. It's really rather taken aback by. In fact, in a lineup, I think Scrappy might come out as taller than he is. but he was generally nice. I mean, for a man who's had his terrible,
these are challenges.
He's had his terrible fair share of mental challenges, but he was a remarkable man, and I think one of the most underrated musical performers of the 80s. Actually,
absolutely.
Stick that in your moral maze. Bye, everyone.
Fardiddly quack quack. Bye.
The price of football. The price of football.